Hello.
Hi.
Happy May. Happy Beltane?
Yes.
Yesterday?
Yeah, I missed it. I was working.
I saw that something you're supposed to do for Beltane or Walpurgisnacht, which is Beltane Eve, which we talked about in some episode, I forget which. One of the traditions is like a bonfire.
Bonfires is like our thing in general.
All of them. Just have a bonfire.
We've got a reasoning for like the bonfire to every single one.
Yeah, true. Now that I think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, shit. They're all bonfires.
Imbolc is a bonfire. And Beltane, it's bonfire. I really think we're just pyromaniacs.
Honestly, sign me up. So I was like, maybe I could have, we have this tiny, very sad little like miniature Weber grill that we like put on our table on the patio. And I'm like, maybe I'll light that up and like, I don't know, have a s'more or something. But then it was really dry out and it was like 45 mile an hour winds. And I was like, yeah, no.
It was so bad. Did you hear about the gigantic pileup there was on like the interstate?
Yeah, Chelsea, who I work with, told me. I was just talking about her. She's the bitch who tells me what to do in a good way. She was saying it was like 80 cars or something.
It was massive because of the wind. It blew a bunch of dust into the interstate and you couldn't see.
What is this fucking Grapes of Wrath bullshit?
I don't know. The wind has been so bad down here lately. I actually, it's funny now.
I'm scared of what you're going to say.
I got pelted by flying totes at work.
I thought you said toads. Okay, totes. Okay.
Totes. Yeah, the totes that we put groceries in. Mm-hmm. It turns out if there's not enough groceries in them, 60 mile per hour winds will launch them straight at your fucking face.
That'll do it.
But the thing is, the power was also out in the building. So we were navigating a power outage and like these catastrophic winds outside. Mm-hmm. I just went out the building dealing with all of the like doors inside not working because half of them are electronic. Get outside. My order tries to kill me.
Oh.
In front of an audience of people. Get it all picked up. Stack it all back up.
Mm-hmm.
Does it again. dodgeball, but with giant plastic toes.
That's terrible, but also I would laugh if I saw it.
I was laughing so hard to avoid crying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And finally, some other associates came over and we all just individually carried the totes out to the cars because I had so many bruises and I was just laughing hysterically.
Oh my God.
But yeah, yikes. the wind has been nuts.
It fucking windy.
I think that every time.
Me too. But no one understands.
Like, I always want to say it to people when I want them to think I'm dumb.
Like, why the fuck are you talking like that? It fucking windy.
And that little fox.
I know. All his hair is blowing back in the wind.
Yes.
It's so good. Anyway, I did not have a bonfire yesterday. Because I think Smokey Bear would have been rather upset with me.
Sarah did not burn down the northern half of Illinois.
No, I could have, but I didn't. And you're welcome. And I think I should get a treat for that. But whatever. I'll get myself a treat, I suppose. Anyway, this is a podcast called Saints and Witches. I'm Sarah. I'm maybe Catholic. Who knows? Tune in next week to find out.
And the epic conclusion.
I know. I just self-immolate on the podcast. I'm maybe Catholic, maybe dead. No, it's not funny. You can't always joke about committing suicide. You can't always do it. At a certain point, people get worried.
Yeah.
Who are you and what are you?
I'm Liz. I am a witch.
This podcast is truly one existential crisis after another, week to week. So if that is your kink, welcome. Speaking of kinks, no, I don't know. What are we talking about today?
I'm talking about the American Southwest.
I am talking about the Franciscan missions in California.
Okay, then we will have connections because I mentioned at least one Franciscan and them doing a bunch of dumb bullshit over.
Yeah, well, that's my whole story. So
dumb bullshit.
Uh-huh. Yep. And over and over again, up and down the coast.
Yeah.
Throughout the centuries, honestly. So this should be fun.
It should be. Let's hop in. So I wrote that today's story isn't much of a story. It kind of became a story, but it's not super cohesive. Mm-hmm. I promise it's still interesting. Bear with me. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing us into the American Southwest, New Mexico, specifically for me to look at the Zuni people. They call themselves the Ashiwi. I don't know if that's correct. I couldn't find a pronunciation online, but it's A:SHIWI. They're the first language I've ever seen that uses colons everywhere in the middle of their words.
Oh shit. Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I've never ever seen it before. But it was very interesting to see like full sentences where you might see like hyphens and things. Mm-hmm. They're using like colons.
Hmm. Okay.
Very cool. I'm hoping that they will forgive me for calling them the Zuni exclusively going forward, but they do put it on their website, so maybe. I don't know.
I've got the same situation.
I don't know what people want to be called. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do my best. I knew I wanted to return to America, but I didn't want to dig around in the colonies again. No offense, like stuck up Puritans, but you're a little bit dull.
Mm-hmm. We're tired of them.
The same things over and over and over again.
With your weird ass names. Okay, temperance. Okay, cotton. Was that cotton. Increase? Okay, increase.
Increase God. In cotton. God. What a family. We should bring those names back.
I actually like unironically agree. Like, let's mix it up. I'm sick of the Jadens and Bradens and Cadens.
Yeah, like we're starting to bring back some of the more classic names like mm-hmm. Edward and Emma and Olivia and stuff like that, but let's go even further mm-hmm. back. Okay,
right.
I want to see some goodies,
right?
And some, like you said, temperance. What are some other Puritan names?
Prudence, patience. Maybe.
Patience,
charity, chastity.
I went to school with a Trinity.
Trinity, that's a good one. Have you seen that girl on that woman on TikTok who talks about who's like she's doing her PhD in like Quaker, something to do with the Quakers, and she talks about the best Quaker names that she's found. Yes. So good.
I can't remember if I shared one of those videos with you or not.
You probably did. That's probably why
I like watching all the the people in the comment section, whenever they're like, oh, I'm related to so-and-so. It's like, look at this little family reunion, this little Quaker family reunion in your comments.
It's very cute. Yeah. I love that.
Yes. All of those kinds of names. I want to see them again.
Mm-hmm. We will.
And Appalachian names. Just anything old. Bring it back. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I didn't want to get into the colonies. Also wasn't super invested in throwing a dart at like a random state and then looking at their folklore and history of witchcraft like we did with Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered if I could do another episode on the indigenous populations of the U.S. like I did many, many moons ago with Leather Lips of the Wyandotte, which is a very good episode, and I recommend visiting it or revisiting it.
Yeah.
I stumbled on some accounts of the Zuni prosecuting natives for witchcraft, and I was like, that's really interesting. You know, it was them prosecuting themselves for witchcraft, and so I kind of dove in from there.
Mm-hmm.
The Zuni people, of which there are about 10,000 today, live in New Mexico on the Zuni Pueblo. I say there are 10,000 today. I didn't write it down, but there were as little as like 1,700 at one point because of disease that like we introduced to the area. So mm-hmm. like, good on them mm-hmm. for surviving us.
I mean, yeah, a lot of tribes did not.
No. So, hooray. Success.
Hooray.
I don't know. I just like seeing small, like, rays of sunshine in this very bleak story.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's that the Zuni people are alive. They have land. They're doing some cool shit. Read about it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the 21st century. They have a website. You can read their newsletters. They have a radio station where they make announcements in their native language to try to keep it alive. They have language programs on the reservation to do the same thing. And I apologize for any of that information that may be out of date or incorrect. I'm getting information from Wikipedia, as always. Wikipedia is Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. I'm getting info from the Smithsonian, which is problematic for a reason that I will get into later. from a paper by J. Andrew Darling called Mass Inhumation and the Execution of Witches in the American Southwest, which I have my issues with, and which cites information from both Zuni Law, a book of research compiled in 1952 I cannot get my hands on, and from research by a guy named Frank Hamilton Cushing, whom I'll talk about extensively later because he is a whole fucking can of worms.
Okay.
I don't want to talk too much about the Zuni. We do have information on their religious beliefs and practices and their way of life. But how we got that information is part of the can of worms that I'm going to open later. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely comfortable sharing everything that I've read because I have no idea what should and should not be shared.
Okay.
To quote the Smithsonian article that I read, although I was invited to several Zuni ceremonies and dances and was warmly greeted, I was also warned not to write about them. Quote, mm-hmm. This is our religion. People outside have the idea that knowledge should be shared, said Jim Inote, the director of the Ashiwi Awan Museum and Heritage Center. That's what universities are built around. But at Zuni, we don't think that way. Some knowledge should be protected and not shared. There are things in Zuni you can know and things you can't. And there are certain people who deserve to be the keepers of that knowledge. It's a privilege, and the rest of us respect them for that. End quote.
Okay.
When I talk about witchcraft later, just having knowledge, the sharing of knowledge, who's allowed to have knowledge, it's all very important to the Zuni.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to go read more, that's on you. But I'm not going to put it out on the airwaves kind of disrespect.
The airwaves. I think that's good. And I think that's the right choice. I had a whole like little cycle go through my brain just now when you were like, I have information, but I can't tell you. And I was like, give me it. Like, that's such a white person mindset. Like, I'm realizing that right now. Yeah, fuck.
It's yours and I want it to be mine.
Fuck, dude. That's fucked up. Anyway, that's where I'm at. Please continue.
It's really hard for me to grapple with, because I know we talk so much about like we want this open exchange of knowledge, because there's mm-hmm. so much like classism in America that keeps people from getting access to knowledge.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, I can also understand this argument that certain people should have knowledge and certain people shouldn't.
Yes.
When it comes to religions and indigenous right. people.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I think our fucking yeah. business.
I, you know? Yeah, it's like, I can get it. I get it. Yeah. Time and a place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to kind of tiptoe, I guess, when it comes to specifics about the Zuni religion. And for where I do overstep, I apologize, because I really have no idea where the boundaries are at.
Yeah.
Archaeological evidence puts the Zuni in the Zuni River Valley for the last 3,000 to 4,000 years farming maize. They've been there for a very, very, very long time, like BC long time.
Mm.
Corn is extremely important to them. It features in their religion and religious ceremonies all the way to their creation story. They've also for centuries harvested salt from the Zuni Salt Lake. The Smithsonian article described the salt as having like a really powdery texture, and the Zuni themselves say that it's superior to other salt. One of them said that like the flavor doesn't roll off food the way that other salt does.
I'm interested in that salt for my kitchen as a white colonizer. Just continue along with this theme. I'm interested in the salt, but it's not my salt to eat.
But they do trade it.
Okay.
Historically have traded it. So it's like, I can see perhaps why you had a lucrative business trading mm-hmm. your salt the way you have described it.
Magic salt.
It sounds appealing.
Mm-hmm.
The Zuni are one of several Pueblo groups. They migrated several times. They traded corn, salt, and turquoise. It also mentioned at one point that they worked with silver. It doesn't say they traded any silver, but that they worked with silver. So I would guess that they probably also traded like silver objects.
Mm-hmm.
And they built several villages over the years, one of which came to be rumored as one of the seven cities of Cibola, or one of the seven cities of gold that the Spanish were looking for.
Oh, I bet this is going to go so well.
Oh, yeah. Just so great.
Everybody's going to get along.
Mm-hmm. They're all going to hold hands and say goodbye. It's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That story, which deserves to be told, it doesn't really have anything to do with witchcraft, but it deserves to be told, begins in 1527 with a conquistador named, I'm going to butcher all the Spanish names, just FYI. Help mm-hmm. me out, Sarah, if you would.
Hello.
Narvaez, maybe?
Yeah, Narvaez.
Yeah.
Cabeza, the guy who wrote about it, Cabeza de Vaca, his narrative. Yeah,
I'm talking about the vaca.
Oh my god. His life story truly is so good. Like, it should be a movie. Anyway, sorry, not to get ahead of you there.
But yeah, he leaves from Spain with 5 ships, 600 men, and a handful of women and slaves to colonize Florida for Ponce de Leon. I love that autocorrect got a hold of that and butchered the fuck out of it without me knowing. These guys are shipwrecked off the coast of Cuba, I believe. Narvaez tries everything to salvage this mission, putting people on rafts, sending them on foot to find a harbor, but the elements pick them off one by one until only 4 people out of the 600 remain, one of whom is a slave named
Estebanico?
Yeah.
Why do I remember that?
It's
this really had an impact on me, this narrative, yes, apparently.
These four men are captured by natives after walking across Texas together and held prisoner for a couple of years until they escape and flee deeper into America. You are just loving this because you know the beats of this story.
I really do. I'll be quiet. But
no, I like this. Over the next few years, they live with natives and acquire reputations as healers, though they finally make it to Mexico City in 1536. When they do, at least one of them, a man named the Vaca,
mm-hmm.
who you have mentioned, has these wild stories about cities of gold that they have seen in their travels. But this dude literally gives nobody any specifics about where they were or who lived in them, or anything at all. And then he just dips back to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, and it was so amazing. Just all this wealth. Just immaculate. Wonderful. Bye.
I love you. Bye.
It's been great, everyone.
Kisses.
So the Viceroy of New Spain hears about all this and is like, well, let's put together an expedition, like, anyway, and just blindly go looking for the cities of gold somewhere in America. And he puts a friar named Marcos de Niza in charge in 1539. And de Niza gets a hold of Estevanico, the slave from the original party of four, and is like, hey, you want to join my gang of, like, dudes who are going to go travel the countryside and trying to find a city of gold? He's like, eh, sure, why not?
I got nothing else going on, so.
He's like, well, I'm a slave, and I don't really enjoy this, so. But the most fun I've had in my life was the last couple of years while I was traveling the countryside, so.
Honestly, yeah. Yeah.
As this party travels, natives hype them up about these fake cities of gold that they're absolutely gonna find along their travels.
Oh my god.
Estevanico, I am diminishing him a tad. He does have his own Wikipedia page. He is astounding for his own reasons. Is sent ahead to scout with his own little party, and he kind of vanishes. Just mysteriously just disappears.
Mm.
A native messenger comes back and tells de Niza that Estevanico is waiting for them in Cibola, saying that Estevanico wanted them to know, quote, there were seven very large cities, which were all subject to one lord. In them were large houses of stone and mortar, the smallest of which were one story high with a terrace. And there were besides two and three storied buildings. The chief's house was of four stories. There were many decorations at the entrance of the principal houses and turquoises, which were very plentiful in the country. The people of these cities were very well clothed. End quote. Estevanico just really wanted you to know this about mm-hmm. the place that he's at.
It's good to know.
When de Niza hurries to Cibola, he receives word that Estevanico has been executed / killed / murdered ?
Yes.
For impersonating a healer. Which he was parading around as a healer with three other men for years after the shipwreck. So
and maybe. It went really well with the other native people. So
yeah. But maybe not for that, but for demanding valuables and women also ? Like, wow. His death is just really strange.
Yeah.
Some accounts say that, and I mean their accounts, say that he tried to conquer the Zuni on behalf of the Spanish. Some say he was executed as a witch. There's no more detail on that at all.
Of course.
Some accounts say he faked his death to gain his freedom and that the natives helped him pull it off.
Ooh, I like that one.
Mm-hmm. Some say he mentioned the other party following behind his party. And the natives freaked out about it, and that's why he got murdered, because they thought, well, now he can't give away our location. Some accounts literally imagine him being shot through with arrows like Saint Sebastian. Like, we literally, this man's body is never, ever found. All we have is a bunch of just people being like, yeah, I don't know. He's just gone, man. He's a bad dude. He did some stuff.
I mean, as mysteriously as he arrived, Also, yeah. I love that his name means little Steven.
Mm-hmm.
So and cute.
I think he may have originally been, from what I kind of glanced over, had an Arabic name. He may have been Muslim. But whenever he was baptized before, like around the time, you know, he's enslaved, he's taken away, he took on the name Esteban.
Like a converso?
Like they baptized him as Christian and they took away his Muslim name and right. You are Esteban now.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think he really had a choice in the matter.
No, I don't think most of them did. No. Most of the conversos. It was.
No, I think it was like, do it or else. I think it was like, I literally own you. And then.
Well, as a slave, yes. But the do it or else, the or else was like murder or exile. Yes. So, like, no one really had a choice.
No.
But he, above all, he especially did not have a choice.
No.
Got it.
It very much feels like they literally just bought him and they're like, okay, cool. On all these documents, I have just changed your name to this. Neat. Now I'm going to ship you over here.
What a life this guy had.
He's amazing. Just all over the place. He did some amazing stuff for an enslaved individual.
Mm-hmm.
Denisa, before leaving the area, having heard that Estevanico has been murdered, takes a glance from the top of like the mesa around, you know, everything that he sees, and then goes back to everybody in Mexico and just makes a whole bunch of shit up.
Oh, great.
Yeah, quote, he wrote of huge pearls and emeralds, and he said that the people ate off of gold and silver plates. He also claimed that the seven cities of Cibola were equal in population to Mexico City, end quote. And it points out there, like, he literally says stuff about a place that he cannot have stepped, like, one toe into.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also is like, but he was actually not super far off in some accounts, because from the top of the mesa, he was looking down at like the trading center of the Pueblo peoples. It was like the Zuni Cibola trading center.
Okay.
Maybe not as immaculate as he thought, but
mm-hmm.
by no means poor.
Yeah.
The viceroy is like, dope. I immediately order another expedition. Don't really care that Estevanico got murdered. That's like, whatever. We're going to do it again. Round two.
Neat.
Yes. A governor in New Spain, a man named Coronado, says, I want to head the expedition up. And he is so sure that these cities of gold exist and that he's going to get a major return in his investments that he finances everything himself.
Whoa.
He takes Denisa, 300 men, 1,000 auxiliaries, and a supply train. And imagine his surprise when he discovers that Denisa just flat out fucking lied.
Mm-hmm. Awkward.
Yeah. So Coronado massacres the Zuni. Just kills them
all. Oh, no.
Yeah. Looking for riches that have to be hidden somewhere, like underneath all the adobe and ceramics. And like, and it's really kind of heartbreaking the way that it's described. It's like traveling through the houses and there's like broken pots and jewelry and everything on the ground and there's bodies and he's literally just trying to find this gold. It's like, dick.
To make matters worse, he steals supplies from their homes after he has murdered them, and then he leaves. And he sends messages out to other native groups that he will be passing through the area and that he is a friend. They quickly catch on that that is a lie, and one brave native, amidst this pillaging and raping and massacre that's happening, steps up and leads Coronado north toward a true city of gold, leads him further and further and further into literally Kansas, until he finally admits that this was all bullshit and that he was just hoping to bring these men out into the wilderness to die of the elements.
Nice.
Yes, and it is upon admitting this that he is struck to death.
Yeah, makes sense.
Coronado doesn't die out in the wilderness, neither does Denisa, but both have soured reputations for the rest of their lives, which I don't feel like is good enough. And this is another thing I didn't write down, but one of the sources I read, one encyclopedia, pointed out that it's like, yeah, whenever you talk about like Coronado and stuff, they point out that it's from his expedition that we have like the first accounts of like the Grand Canyon by like the Spanish and all of these interesting things. He's like, but in the analogy that it makes, it's like, if somebody robs a bank and kills every single person in the bank, and then in the process of the bank robbery discovers one rare coin, why are we focusing on the coin and discounting everything else that happened?
Yeah. Yep. I've got a lot of that in my story too. The not necessarily all like justifications, but like those little qualifiers that like scholars give, you know, where they're like, well, someone was gonna make contact with the native people eventually. Like, did you want it to be the Russians? It's like, why do I have to choose between those two? You know, like, I don't know which would have been better.
Clearly, whoever it was didn't do a great job. Like,
no, it's never gone great. Like, European people visiting native people has never once gone well. And like, yeah, it might have been different. I don't know that it would have been better or worse. Like, who's, I don't know. But like, Jesus fucking Christ.
All day long to diminish the horrible things that Europeans did. But
yep.
We still did them, so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now going to skip ahead a couple hundred years to the 1850s. Not to say that there isn't a bunch of really interesting history about the Zuni people in the interim. I recommend reading about the Pueblo revolt of the late 1680s. It's really interesting. Essentially, the Spanish and like a bunch of Franciscans come in and decide to take over the natives in the area and convert a whole bunch of them. And then they fight back. And it's pretty dope.
Nice.
But in 1857, a man named Frank Hamilton Cushing is born. He is born in Pennsylvania, and as a kid, he is fascinated with Native Americans. He publishes his first scientific paper at 17. He briefly attends Cornell University, and he attracts the attention of the Smithsonian for an exhibit he curated of Native artifacts while he was at Cornell. By 19 years old, Cushing is appointed curator of the ethnology department of the Smithsonian's National Museum in D.C. So very young, very accomplished.
Yeah.
From there, he draws further attention and is invited at 22 to join an anthropological expedition to New Mexico, where this group travels to Las Vegas, New Mexico, which I didn't know that there were.
That existed.
It's apparently small. I think it said it had like 13,000 people. Then heads on from there to the Zuni Pueblo. Cushing is dissatisfied with observing the Zuni from a distance, so he actually plunks his bedroll down in the tribal governor's house, and from there steadily becomes part of the Zuni people. And he is actually the first recorded participant observer, like anthropologist. Mm-hmm. So he takes on a Zuni name, wears their clothes, participates in their rituals. He's initiated into something called the Priesthood of the Bow, which is a warrior group. And it's mentioned in J. Andrew Darling's paper frequently as the group of people responsible for handling witch trials in Zuni culture.
Okay.
Cushing himself was suspected of witchcraft a couple of times as an outsider ingratiating himself to Zuni to take their knowledge. I said knowledge was extremely important, though he does escape punishment. And I will take a moment here to talk a little bit about Zuni culture and witchcraft before I finish out Cushing Story. Avoiding creation stories, witches themselves purportedly exist alongside humans and therefore aren't supernatural, despite being, quote, of a different breath. This is never really explained, this distinction, but to my best understanding, because they aren't gods or creatures or like elusive things you can't clap your eyes on whenever you want to, like they're literally down in the trenches with you existing day by day. They aren't supernatural, even though they literally have to like kill humans or die themselves because that's how they get their energies, like other people's life forces.
Okay.
I'm simplifying. I'm generalizing. You get the gist. Obviously, yeah. Not every single tribe is going to have the same beliefs.
Right.
It's mostly outsiders who are suspected of being witches, but people can become witches. So that's when you see accusations happen within communities. Or see a tribe levy accusations at the family members of someone they just decided was a witch. So, like, it's not so much like somebody gets accused and they throw their family members under the bus. It's you could have indoctrinated your family, so we're going to accuse them now.
Oh, okay.
Witches are suspected of many things, usually during times of stress, like disease or drought, conflict. These things include, but are not limited to, cannibalism, necrophilia, grave robbery, murder, bewitchment, causing drought, causing plague, heresy, causing sickness, setting fires, destroying crops, reanimating the dead, and simply having secret knowledge.
So just the basics, really.
Just the basics.
Okay.
You accidentally setting fire to Northern Illinois.
Ooh.
Yeah, big red flag.
Got it. Noted.
Like I said before, the Bow priesthood, not the tribal council, was responsible for dealing with witchcraft. Interrogation usually consisted of clubbing or the accused being hung by their arms or thumbs behind their backs. I know clubbing is just such a way to interrogate somebody.
I know. I was like, okay, we're skipping right to the
clubbing.
No questions, just clubs. Got it.
I'm gonna try and show you this picture. You see Ooh, that?
Yeah, yeah.
And hung. It's very similar to like the strapado. Kind of. Being hoisted behind your back. I'll probably post this photo. It's one of the first ones that I saw that kind of convinced me to write about this. The witch might be let down occasionally to go back to their house and turn over occult items. So they did get a break from the light clubbing.
I would be invoking that nonstop. I'd be like, hang on, I just remembered.
Some occult objects.
I thought of another occult item. I bring it back. It's my toothbrush. Like, literally just stalling for time.
This one is like everybody turn around, and then you dig that brush and you start wrapping something around it. Some cloth, some bone. And then
my magic wand.
The papers waffle back and forth on whether the purpose of witch trials was to expose arcane knowledge, which would weaken it by account of everybody knowing it, or if bow priests simply were trying to get their hands on this information for themselves. I don't know. They don't really know. But again, you can see how who has the knowledge, whether knowledge is kept by a select few or known by everybody. Like, knowledge has power. It is important. Who has it has vast implications. There is a chart that I'll probably post that shows 22 Zuni trials broken down into date, sex, age, accusation, trial location, execution method, etc. It's very neat to see. It's another thing that convinced me to write about this. Only 5 of the 22 are executed. It does note where there was outside intervention by people like anthropologists. But there were only 6 death sentences originally anyway. So the only one of the death sentences wasn't carried out.
Mm.
Most of the sentences were like ostracism or fines or beatings. Which it's like,
got it.
We beat you to get your confession, and your reward is more beatings.
More beatings.
You guess what you won?
A new beating. Congratulations. Yeah.
That's what I've always wanted. We don't know, I guess, 100% what happened to the bodies of the executed witches. It was handled by bow priests. One case, it was mentioned the bodies were left to rot in the sun, but Darling's paper makes a lot of speculation about burning and defleshing based on osteological finds that others think are evidence of cannibalism. That he So they saw a lot of this, like these bones and the marks on them, and they're like, ah, the natives, they were eating each other. And he's like, no, well, if you look at witch legends, like, cannibalism was a no-no and got you, like, executed. So maybe they defleshed, like, witches after they killed them. But then at the same time, my contention with the paper was, like, it spent several pages talking about, like, all of these stories about cannibalism. Like, all of these people who had accused other people of cannibalism, and then that's why they were accused as witches. And then he's like, there was no cannibalism because they didn't like cannibals. It's like, you just gave me, like, 6 pages worth of stories about all these people who were accused of eating people. Right. So clearly, like, were they eating people or were they not eating people?
I mean, every culture has, like, just because something is against their values doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Like, you know, like, we don't like cannibals either, but, like, people do it.
Yeah, that was just my only thing. There was no entertaining the possibility that any of those stories could have possibly been true. It's like, well, they're just stories. It's like, I don't think you can really have it both ways.
No, you can't. And I think a lot of, like, white people writing about Native culture do stuff like that, where they're like, it's just a very, like, simplistic way of looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're like, well, they didn't like this, so this is a rule in their culture. It's like, well, who enforces it? And, like, what are the rules of our culture? I don't fucking know. There's a lot of, like, unspoken rules, but, like, it's different everywhere.
There's so many faulty conclusions that you could draw about American culture based on the way that we do things.
Mm-hmm.
I digress. Anyway, that was kind of my issue with the paper, is it just presented these arguments but didn't really follow the thinking, like, all the way through. All I know is that body disposal was very important to Pueblo groups. They would guard graves so that souls could depart from their bodies and make the necessary journey without interruption by, say, witches. A set of paintings in one area depicts a practice called corpse pounding, which made my teeth hurt the whole time I read. But essentially, to make sure a spirit leaves the body, doesn't get trapped there, doesn't try to stay, and that nothing else tries to inhabit or revive the body, like, say, a witch, a male relative would take a wood or stone mallet to a body in a partially filled grave and, quote, the buried corpse is struck first over the face, knocking the teeth out, then all over the body. They claim if they do not pound, he or she may come to life and suffer in the dirt. Sometimes after the grave is pounded, the dirt lowers about 3 or 5 inches.
Oh my God.
Yes.
They're really beating the shit out of those corpses. Holy yes. crap. Okay.
And I was like, what the midsummer is this?
No, I'd rather be a corpse or a ghost. I'd rather be a ghost. I'd rather be fucking reanimated than have my corpse would pounded be a to death. Right. Yikes.
I understand. It helps the deceased. Like, it's very important to them that they're like, we're terrified of our loved one being trapped under the dirt and suffering.
Sure.
So we want them to be able to move on to the spirit world. It's like, cool. That's wonderful. But it also protects the community from spirits of the dead. One, from either lingering around, or two, if witches were try to reanimate the dead. It could be a problem for the community. It's like, I understand, like, twofold, that you're trying to do your loved one and your community a service. It does still make my teeth hurt.
It does still fucking freak me out. But it's also, like, I mean, I don't have to be corpse pounded, so.
Funerals, to an extent, freak me out. Like, why do we put a corpse at the front of the room and come stare at it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everyone has death rituals. We don't know what to do about the fact that we die.
No, we're like, what if we just, like, sew it together a little bit and inject it with some chemicals and, you know, stuff it. So it looks like grandpa. Mm-hmm. So that we can come cry and listen to his favorite music. And then bury him in the ground.
And then never talk again for 10 years. Bye. Yeah.
So fucking weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need healthier ways to deal with death, I think.
Yeah, I think everybody needs to do more psychedelics.
Yeah. It's a requirement whenever I pass. Everyone who knows me, if anybody gives a shit or is still alive, all just has to do the shrooms that I never got to. Room together, high off their asses.
I'll do it alone in the privacy of my home and the safety of my own home. But yes, I will do that for you. No problem.
Okay. Yeah. If anything ever happens to me, please do some shrooms in my own
room. Spit out my wine almost. It went up my nose a little. Ooh, spicy. My eyes are watering.
Whatever happens to witches, they would have had a special meeting and it would have been for the good of the community. We don't know what, but whatever. Anyway, back to Cushing. Some of this information comes from him, I believe, so I feel a little bit icky sharing some of it. But he wrote several works, and what I've summarized comes from a 22-paged article that is partially about archaeological findings, so I'm going to go out on a limb and say he probably wrote about a lot of other stuff I don't know about. What is bad about Cushing, beyond publishing secrets, is that he kind of helps the Zuni and betrays them in, like, the same breath. So in 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes, who I know nothing about other than his name.
I always, when we were in third grade, we had to paint watercolor presidential portraits. Did you do that propaganda exercise?
No, we just had to do a bunch of presidential reports.
Someone at my little desk cluster watercolored Rutherford B. Hayes. And she would do this thing where every time it was time to work on our little watercolors and we, like, got our paints out and stuff, because it took, like, weeks to finish these, because we only worked on them, like, 5 minutes at a time, it seemed like. But anyway, every day, because she was, like, stressed out about her painting and, like, worried that she was going to fuck it up every time. So every time she would talk to Rutherford and she would be like, Rutherford, behave. Like, behave. So funny for an 8-year-old. Anyway, that's what I think of now whenever I see his name.
That's adorable.
Very cute.
That's so cute. Not so cute is that he signs a bill defining the boundaries of the Zuni reservation, but he leaves off a whole 800 acre tract of their land when he does it. I don't know if he does it on purpose or not, but he does it.
Rutherford behaves. Ridiculous.
Land spectators, three men show up to claim this 800 acre plot for cattle ranching. One of the men is W.F. Tucker, Major W.F. Tucker. He's got a name on him. The Zuni are mad though, like mad that this has happened, as they should be. If you're living on a plot of land and the president's just like, whoopsie daisy, I forgot about 800 whole acres there. Now some white men have shown up and they're trying to kick you off your space.
Oh, well.
Some cattle there. So anyway, the Zuni are like, hey, Cushing, could you maybe ask your people to give us our land back? And Cushing is like, yeah, definitely. Sure, I'll do that. And he writes a bunch of letters to newspapers in Boston and Chicago calling out, like, this whole situation that has happened. Well, who is Major W.F. Tucker's father-in-law but U.S. Senator John A. Logan?
No way.
I know. Actually,
colliding.
To be part of the story until, like, 2 hours ago.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just stumbling along looking for more stuff to cram in here, and John A. Logan.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know, John A. Logan is like very important to our little Southern Illinois area.
He's a local celebrity.
Yes, he is. We have a college named after him, and like got his own little spot in one of our cemeteries, right?
Probably.
I think he does. I forget. Logan is a senator, but he'll also be a vice presidential candidate, and he's just all tied up in politics, and he is pissed that he is now attached to this whole, quote, land grab scandal, thanks to Cushing. The Zuni do get their land back, but Logan threatens the Bureau of Ethnology, which is responsible for Cushing's anthropological expedition into New Mexico, with budget cuts if they do not yank Cushing out of there immediately.
Mm.
So they, and I'm so used to him being like a local celebrity around here that I'm like, John A. Logan did what?
How dare he? Not our boy.
He blackmailed the Bureau of Ethnology.
Our boy would never. My son has done nothing wrong. What'd you say? Sorry.
That he's a Republican, so.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. That tracks.
Right.
The controversy surrounding Cushing comes when everybody starts realizing the Smithsonian now has over 10,000 Zuni artifacts in their possession, and those artifacts started shipping the same year Cushing took up living with the Zuni.
Oh, gee, that's a coincidence.
What a co-winky dink.
Yeah.
This is why I say the Smithsonian is problematic as like a source when I mention that article. On one hand, the article I read of theirs goes like out of its way at one point just randomly to like mention Cushing, like have one of the Zuni people bring up Cushing and then like a positive light saying that like he's a good guy they admire, but unfortunately he's also a crook, like sad face. Like, so disappointing.
There are like, two wolves inside all of us.
And one literally
steals Native American artifacts, and one is like kind of chill sometimes. You know, like, what can you do?
Whoopsie daisy.
Yeah.
But literally, it found like it was just so forced that it kept talking about how like knowledge that had been lost among the Zuni people and how one of the natives had taken one of Cushing's books and was using it to like relearn some stuff and like make hand carved like fetishes. And it's like, oh wow, thanks to the white guy,
mm-hmm.
culture lives on. And yep. It's like, are you fucking kidding me?
It's I got a lot of that too.
How many Zuni people hated him before you found like the one Zuni person who was like, he's pretty okay?
How many people did you have to talk to? Yeah.
Because I just don't buy that that's like the by and large like overwhelming opinion of Cushing.
No.
Especially whenever like he worked for you in the past.
Right.
Anyway. It also, it felt like the article was trying to paint themselves as like these uber sensitive anthropologists now who follow all the rules and they would never make anything available for public consumption that they weren't supposed to. The whole thing of like, you know, this is our religion and I was told not to write anything about it and so I didn't. It's like, cool, that's not what happened like 200 years ago.
Right. Congratulations. That's so literally not what we're talking about.
Are you going to give back their 10,000 artifacts?
Right. That would be a start.
Are you going to unpublish Cushing's works?
Right.
Artifacts are now, unfortunately, as far away as Europe because of this outright theft. And that made me really sad that these religious artifacts have traveled from New Mexico to, like, Germany. And they're probably never, ever, ever going to get them back.
Yeah, that sucks.
It's also sad that Cushing doctored some of the artifacts or made some himself, so some of them should be considered outright forgeries.
Mm.
I don't know why. I think he like enhanced them or whatever. Cushing continued to work with natives. I don't know why or how, why they had anything to do with him.
Mm.
Until on April 10th, 1900, at the age of 42, he died of hemorrhaging due to choking on a fishbone during a research project.
Oh, apparently, shit.
It is complete karma.
Right.
As they should. That, though, was a very brief history of the Zuni people, from Spanish expeditions for gold to witch trials to anthropological thievery.
That was good. I think you did a good job of framing the story so that it made sense but didn't feel like exploitative, although I am another white person saying that to you, you know, but like, for what it's worth, I think you did a good job with it.
I did my best. Did I write the entire thing in 2 hours? Yes. Did I have a complete panic attack the more and more that I read about Cushing and realized that he stole all of this information and that I probably shouldn't write about it? And then it's like, well, what the fuck am I gonna write about? Yes. And then it's I've gotta fill this with something if I can't talk about any of the stuff that I've been reading about for the last week. And then I was like, what if I just talk about him and about the Spanish?
Yeah, it can't be worse than me realizing that one guy was on Ancient Aliens. Jesus Christ. But literally,
I've been reading, especially from like other blogs and like Wikipedia and just all of this stuff, all of this information about like their creation stories and witches and blah, da, 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 da. And it's just like, I'll talk about all of this. And then literally this morning, like I wake up and it's like, huh, I wonder who all of these people cited down at the bottom are. Mm. And then I Googled Cushing and it's like, oh no, oh no. Oh,
I mean, no. That is the truth of this type of research, though. Like, you could easily have ignored that and been like, I'm going to tell the most interesting story possible. And like, fuck ethics and fuck like the native people who wanted these secrets to be kept, and like who cares, like I'm gonna tell a cool story. But you didn't.
Yeah,
I mean, you did tell a cool story. But I mean,
do my best when I post pictures too, because there's some that are disputed where they say that like somebody came and took these photos under like false pretenses, or took photos of like garb that they weren't supposed to. So I'm going to do my best to, whenever I go to put photos on Instagram, make sure I screen who the photographer was so that I'm not putting anything up that I shouldn't. I'm gonna do my best.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's good.
Anyway, regale me with more of, like, the Spanish being the first capital, T, capital W.
God, okay, I will. So when you texted me with a list of themes, I knew immediately who I was going to talk about because I've been putting this one off for a long time. So this is Saint Junipero Serra. I know it's pronounced Serra, but I can't do that rolled R really quickly within the word. So I'm going to say Serra, but there's two R's there, just so you know. Junipero Serra is the Spanish Franciscan friar who established missions in Mexico and all across California, earning him the title of Apostle of California. I've been putting this off because it's a bummer, as are all the colonization stories. The Spanish missions in Mexico and California are widely considered today to have been a form of genocide by the Spanish crown and the Catholic Church against the indigenous peoples of the area. So it's a tough story to hear, but it needs to be told. So I read the writings of Junipero Serra, which include his letters as well as his diaries. They're in four volumes. They're all in the public domain. They're all available online. I also read the book Junipero Serra, California's Founding Father. I read a collection of essays titled The Missions of California, A Legacy of Genocide. You can see, I feel like just with those two titles, the polarizing views of him, which is just, it's fascinating. And like, I don't know. I'll save those thoughts for later. And I listened to a podcast called Junipero Serra, Context and Representation. This was like a series of recordings of talks from an exhibition on him by the Huntington Library in 2013, which is 10 years ago that we graduated high school, which feels illegal.
It was not that long ago.
Okay. Let's move on.
Existential crisis.
Okay. People are like planning my 10-year high school reunion on Facebook. I'm like, first of all, I'd rather die than go to that. But
I know. It's like, I don't want to go drink a beer with a bunch of rednecks.
Yeah, we'll not be doing that. Thank you so much for the invitation. We'll especially not be paying $50 to do that. What the fuck? So let's talk about Junipero Serra. We pretty much know next to nothing about his early life, but here are the details we do know. He was born on November 24th, 1713, to parents Antonio Nadal Serra and Margarita Rosa Ferrer in the village of Petra on the Spanish island of Mallorca. He was baptized Miguel José Serra y Ferrer. The family were farmers who were just like right on the edge of poverty all the time. And Miguel worked on the farm as a child and attended primary school at the local Franciscan friary, where he learned reading, writing, mathematics, and Latin, as well as obviously religious studies. He and his family were friendly with the Franciscan monks who often let Miguel sing in their choir. At age 16, he enrolled in the Franciscan school in the capital city of Palma, where he studied philosophy, and a year later he became a Franciscan novice. He took the name Junipero after Brother Juniper, who had been one of St. Francis's original companions. The course of study to become a priest took 7 years, during which time Serra studied logic, metaphysics, and cosmology, as well as, obviously, theology. He was a very smart guy, according to all accounts. His peers wrote that he was brilliant. I expect you and I will be the judge of that as the story continues. In his free time, Serra devoured the stories of the missionaries in New Spain. As we saw way back in episode 50, Franciscans were the first missionaries to arrive in New Spain, just a few years after the Cortez expeditions. So at this point, they've been a presence in New Spain for over 200 years already.
That's too much.
Doesn't it seem like, I mean, that is the amount of time that America has been a country.
Mm-hmm.
That's just Spain was all up in Mexico and like Texas and stuff and California for that long. In 1737, Serra finally became a priest and began teaching a three-year philosophy course. He became known as a very engaging preacher. He used a lot of like vernacular figurative language in his preaching to like relate his ideas to what the villagers experienced every day, like farming and carpentry. He was like trying to dumb shit down so they would understand, but it worked. So already when he's still in Mallorca, we can see in his sermons, you know, like the themes of which have been discussed in like hagiographies and stuff like that. So like, who knows exactly what he was preaching, but like, we can see the threads that will later come up again when he preaches at the missions in New Spain. One of these ideas or themes that he often talked about was punishment. The question of why God seems to punish humans with suffering. When he preached about this, more than once, he used the metaphor of a doctor caring for a patient. He would say, like, which is the better doctor? The one who, like, gives the patient a little pat on the head and, like, a piece of candy? Or the doctor who prescribes the painful treatment that the patient actually needs to get better? He also related it to a father punishing his children, which he supported. He was a big fan of corporal punishment. He would often self-flagellate with a whip, even sometimes while he was preaching. He's got an interesting thing. He really likes his suffering to be witnessed. Franciscans, it's his kink for sure, which like already goes against like what kinks are supposed to be, right? When you involve unwilling participants, like isn't that like the number one rule? So Franciscans in particular are known for self-flagellation, but you're supposed to do it in private. The point of it is that nobody should know but you, like you and God. It should be your and God's little secret that you're doing it. But throughout my research, I kept having the thought that he liked when people witnessed him in pain or otherwise suffering. So just keep that in mind as we go along, I guess.
Fascinated with pain.
Mm-hmm. Big time. He is a fan of pain and suffering and punishment. So while he was teaching his three-year philosophy course, he became close with one of his students, Francisco Palau, who will return throughout the story. He would actually become Serra's first hagiographer. So after teaching the philosophy course, Serra went on to receive his doctorate in theology. In 1748, when he was 35 years old, his mentor died, which seems to have been a turning point for him. He apparently realized that if he stayed in Mallorca his whole life, like his mentor had, he might become a prestigious priest and scholar there. He might be well known and well respected on the island, but that was really all there was for him if he stayed. And according to hagiography, it was at this point that he heard this internal voice telling him that he was meant to go and convert the Gentiles. Also sort of like simultaneously, and maybe probably related to this, life in Mallorca in the 1740s was not chill. All of Europe was experiencing really weird weather, in particular dry, cold winters, which of course devastated agriculture and food production and caused famine and disease throughout the continent. Mallorca in particular was hard hit because agriculture was already kind of tough and unreliable there. And the island depended on a lot of foreign food sources. So it's possible that those conditions might have also been a factor in Serra's wanting to leave the island. He kept this desire to himself for a while because he wasn't sure whether the voice he'd heard was the voice of God or like what the actual fuck was going on. And also because he was afraid of going to New Spain alone. He really wanted a buddy, but like didn't know how to ask because like, how do you ask someone to go with you? Like, hey, do you want to like suffer together? Like real bad and probably die across the sea and never see our loved ones ever again. So unbeknownst to him, his friend and former student, Francisco Palau, was also thinking of becoming a missionary. And one day he came to Serra and asked for his advice on whether he should go. And Serra was like, oh my God, thank God.
Like, my advice is you should go. And do you need a buddy?
Right, exactly. I would love to be your buddy. Let's do this. I'm so glad you said that. So the two of them immediately decided to apply to the colonial bureaucracy together. They were eventually accepted and they set sail for Cadiz, which was the port of departure to the Spanish colonies. While waiting for their ship to take them to New Spain, Serra wrote a farewell letter to his family. He said in the letter that he knew they were sad that he was leaving, but he said he wished he could give them some of his happiness because he knew that he was following his destiny. He urged his family to be good Christians. In particular, he wanted his nieces and his nephew to go to a good Christian school and to be good for his sister and his brother-in-law. And he concluded the letter with a prayer that the Lord would bring them all together someday again. That letter was dated August 20th, 1749, and his next letter is dated December 14th of that year. A whole season has passed. This letter is addressed to his superior in Mallorca, and it's sent from Veracruz in New Spain. Veracruz was the same place Cortes had landed in 1521, and over 200 years later, it was still Spain's only official port in what is now Mexico. So in this letter, Serra writes about the voyage from Cadiz to Veracruz with a brief stopover in Puerto Rico. He says the worst part of the trip to Puerto Rico was the rationing of water. Everyone only got like a tiny little glass of water a day. He says specifically in the letters, like, oh, you know, those like little glasses that we sometimes used to use at dinner. they were about that size and not even full to the top. so like, who knows how big those glasses were, but I just like that we get that, like, oh, remember the glasses in the dining room at the friary? Yeah, the little ones. he said he would have drunk water from a mud puddle if he could have found one. On October 18th, they landed in Puerto Rico and stayed at the hospice of Mary Immaculate until October 31st, when they set sail for Veracruz, which they finally reached on December 6th. So, for a little bit of background, during the two centuries between Cortes's conquest and our story, the Spanish crown had been fighting wars with the native people to keep control of these lands pretty much the entire time. You talked about one episode of that. It was all the time everywhere that that was happening. Spanish colonization is really interesting because because of how intertwined the political and religious aspects of it were. We don't always see that in European colonization, but since the Reconquista, which was when Spain joined forces with the Catholic Church to reclaim the Iberian Peninsula from Muslim control, ever since then, Spain and the church had been besties. The church had political power in Spain, and the crown had ecclesiastical control. They melded together in a unique way. Spain's identity was Catholic, so the missions that we'll talk about are both religious and political. And the way that they worked was through a system called an encomienda, where the Spanish colonizers asserted that they had the right to collect tribute from the native people in a specific area. And in return, the role of the Spanish was to protect the native people and to provide them with a Catholic education. And the common mission structure had three parts to it. There was the misión itself with the church and the priest quarters and where all the friars lived and stuff. Then there was the presidio, or the royal fort, where the local authority would live, like the governor or whatever. And finally, there was the pueblo, or town, where the common people would live, both the indigenous people and the settlers. Although, as we'll see, there were issues with that, and it wasn't always harmonious, not just between colonizers and native people, but between the government and the missionaries. So these three things were clustered together and meant to work as one unit, like meant to mirror a Spanish city with the town, the castle, and the church. And all of it is guarded by Spanish soldiers, also known as encomenderos. So that's the general structure, and we'll see how it plays out at different missions in the story. So we're going to be talking about three major areas of Spanish Franciscan missions in New Spain. First, the Sierra Gorda missions in the modern-day Mexican state of Querétaro. Then the Baja California missions on the modern Mexican peninsula of the same name. And finally, the Alta California missions, which were all up and down the coast of modern day California. Baja, or Lower California, and Alta, or Upper California, is sometimes referred to collectively as Las Californias. So the first step of the journey for Serra, Palau, and their companions was from Veracruz to the College of San Fernando de Mexico in Mexico City, which was the regional headquarters of the Franciscan missions. Not a short trip. The route they took was the first leg of what was called the Camino Real, or Royal Path, which went all the way to Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was not for the faint of heart. The altitude variation alone was from sea level to 7,400 feet. It passed through, because I can't like put things into context that are numbers, 8,000 feet is when you start getting altitude sickness, when most people start getting it. So like literally from New Orleans to like the point where you would get altitude sickness, they had to walk. Not chill. The road passed through tropical forest and mountains. The royal officials that had sailed with the Franciscans offered them horses, and most of the friars accepted, but Serra and Palau refused in order to better follow the example of Saint Francis, who had said that friars should not ride on horseback unless, you know, they were gravely ill or some other like weird situation. So the two of them made the trek to Mexico City alone, on foot, with no money. On the way, Serra was bitten on the leg by a mosquito, and he scratched so much that the wound became infected. This wound would bother him for the rest of his life. He was a big fan of this injury and would often display his disgusting infected leg by wearing sandals instead of closed-toed shoes. This is what I mean when I say the witness my suffering kind of thing with him.
Like him a whole lot. He would have gotten along.
No, probably not.
I feel like everything would have been a little bit of a competition with him.
He's definitely a one-upper. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, I was bitten on the leg 300 miles ago, so... Like, okay, you got a mosquito bite.
That you made a big deal.
That you infected yourself with your own dirty little fingers, so...
Freak.
Maybe it's a freak. Maybe don't go broadcasting it. It's kind of embarrassing, actually. So, but they finally made it to Mexico City. And after a couple years there, they were eventually assigned to the mission of Jalpan in the Sierra Gorda, which was about 360 kilometers north of Mexico City. Jalpan was kind of in the middle of nowhere in a very mountainous region that was home to a few scattered Spanish settlers and the indigenous Pame people, who had so far mostly avoided being converted and subjected to Spanish rule. But all that was about to change.
And it sucks.
Sarah and Palau arrived to find the mission in a very sorry state. Things were in disarray. There were barely any parishioners, and they weren't attending mass or confession regularly. So the two friars whipped things into shape, literally. They worked with the College of San Fernando to have supplies brought to the mission, including farming tools and livestock, and they supervised the native people's labor at the mission. The men were made to work on the farms, and the women were taught to knit and sew. The products of native people's labor were distributed among the mission residents according to need. Native people were allowed to sell the surplus at the markets under the supervision of the friars, who were supposed to make sure that the Spanish and other settlers didn't cheat the native people. And some native men who successfully assimilated into mission life were given their own parcels of land eventually. Like I mentioned before, soldiers and other political officials were also present at the mission. One of the jobs of soldiers was to track down native people who escaped the mission and bring them back. The Franciscans' goal was to have everybody in the area living at the mission under their supervision. We see in the sources, they call it being under the bell. So like logistically, that means they wanted people within hearing distance of the mission bell at all times. So they would know when like mass was going on, but also figuratively under the bell is under their care and their very watchful eye.
This just seems like, I'm sorry.
It feels like what? You cut out.
Slavery.
It is. We're getting to that. Don't worry. We will discuss.
Thinly veiled slavery.
Not even thinly veiled. Not even veiled. So any escapees were hunted down and brought back by the soldiers. They would sometimes be publicly whipped in order to deter others from leaving. So now the not great aspects of mission life. I mean, none of it is great. Native populations everywhere were decimated by European diseases, just to begin with. So there's contention in the sources, which first of all are flawed because, you know, we don't have written records from native sources. So mm-hmm. like we're starting with an unjust sort of picture of things. But the sources are fighting about whether native people were forced to work on mission farms and to build mission churches, whether they were paid with money or food, or like also how severely they were punished. It seems like there was variation in treatment from mission to mission, but there was a common system, and it probably included at least a bit of forced labor and corporal punishment, which goes back to like Sarah's beliefs about punishment and its positive outcomes, the doctor treating the patient and the father beating his child. So it's a very paternalistic, dehumanizing form of treatment. But of course, the friars felt completely justified by scripture and by the Franciscan rule to do this. So single men and unmarried women were separated at missions. This was partly so that the church could control marriages, and partly to protect native women from Spanish soldiers. Sarah, in particular, seems to have been very concerned about this. He was really vocal throughout his whole missionary career in speaking out against the Spanish soldiers. Like, he wasn't afraid to talk shit about them. And he generally believed them. It
hurt me.
Right. I wish you wouldn't. What are you going to do, bit me? So he generally thought that the Spanish soldiers were like disgusting, horrible pig men, which they were. especially the ones out on the frontier at these missions. If you were a good Spanish soldier, you would be in Mexico City guarding the viceroy. You would not be out in Alta California, like supervising a mission. So there was a lot of drinking and gambling going on. There was a lot of sexual abuse of native women. Sarah wrote to his superior constantly asking for certain soldiers to be punished for their offenses. He seems like he did his best in the context of mission life to protect, to do what he thought was protecting native women from them. Unfortunately, the system that was used for this protection was very flawed and generally terrible. Girls were usually taken from their families around age 7 and brought to the mission's monjería, the women's dormitory. These monjerías were overcrowded, disease-ridden, filthy. The women were hardly ever allowed outside, like pretty much just they could walk to the church and back. And I read these like really, I mean, it's just like gut-wrenching stories of like someone observing from afar, like a soldier writing about it, for example, where like, you know, the priests would come unlock the door. And the women would just come rushing out and like trying to breathe all the fresh air that they could and like soak up like the little bit of sunlight that they could before they were like herded into the church by the priests. And that image really stuck with me. I don't have anything profound to say about it. I just thought I would share. We, of course, have reports of sexual abuse in these monjerías, either by priests themselves or by Spanish soldiers who would pay priests to open the door for them. This is, like, generally speaking, not necessarily at Jalpan or any of Sarah's missions. I don't know for sure, but just generally we have reports like that. The separation of native children from their parents alone served a very important function for the missionaries in that it created a generational gap of indigenous knowledge of their own cultural practices, which is genocide. Mm-hmm. And of course they didn't see it that way. To them it was salvation, but anyway, in the Sierra Gorda, Sarah established 5 missions. And in the course of doing this, he and the other Franciscans came into conflict with the Spanish settlers who were trying to claim Pame land, including mission land. So these land conflicts did happen even with how intertwined the secular and religious were. Sarah and the College of San Fernando sided with the native people because the native lands were also the mission lands. So of course they did. And it's during this conflict that we get a really interesting little moment in Sarah's writings. In 1752, he wrote to the local headquarters of the Spanish Inquisition. and he asked for an inquisitor to be appointed to oversee the Sierra Gorda missions. And the Inquisition was like, of course we know him. He's you. He played himself. Accidentally volunteered for the job. So he became an inquisitor. And it seems like he had asked for help because he suspected witchcraft on the missions. I debated whether I was going to talk about this because it's your territory for sure. But there really is no information on it besides like one letter of his. So he writes in his letter to the Inquisition that, quote, in the district of this mission of mine and its neighborhood, there are several persons of the class known as gente de razón, that is to say that they are not Indians, who are addicted to the most detestable and horrible crimes of sorcery, witchcraft, and devil worship. In the letter, he names two women. One is Melchora de los Reyes Acosta, who is a married Spanish settler who lives on the mission. And the other is a woman named Cayetana, who is Mexican. Both of these women are mixed race, by the way. Not a great look. For him to accuse them, not for them to be mixed race. Sorry, just to clarify. So he says that they have been holding Cayetana under arrest for several days already, and that she has confessed, presumably under torture, although he doesn't specify that. The story that she apparently gave is that in the area there is a coven of witches that she is a part of. They are not native people, although there are some native people that sometimes meet up with them. And these witches fly through the air at night and meet at a cave on a hill called El Saucillo, where they make sacrifices to the demons that appear there in the form of goats and other animals. We've seen it before.
So Spanish, like so heavily Spanish.
Yes. And like, but I think both of these women were born in New Spain.
Yeah, and this is like Spanish ideas of witchcraft that right. they have only gotten from them.
Yeah.
Like the caves, the flying demon yep. devil worship is all Spanish.
Yes, and I know for a fact, I mean, I don't know that the first woman was born in Spain, but Cayetana, who is telling the story, is Mexican. So, like, truly just, like, feeding her these lines. Like, how would she know to say these things? So, yes, I assume torture. We don't know for sure. And, like, that's it for this little episode. Like, he tells what she said, apparently, and then he says that, oh, something needs to be done about this because I'm worried that this witchcraft is going to spread to the native people and it's going to corrupt them. And I'm trying to make them children of God. So, like, can you hurry up and do something, please? And that's it. Like, it's so random. We don't know what happens to the women. He doesn't go on to write more things like this. So what I thought of, which is just a guess, but I was like, okay, he wants these settlers off mission lands. And this is like a really good way to do that. Like, these people are a bad influence, and like, this is specifically how, and I want them gone, please. I don't know for sure if they're connected, but that was what I thought. Mm-hmm. So a few years later, the Viceroy of New Spain ordered all of the settlers to leave the mission area. So if that was his goal, it worked very well. Shortly after that, Serra returned to the College of San Fernando and worked there as an administrator for a few years until 1767. In 1767, the Jesuits were expelled from the peninsula of Baja California, because of course they were.
Those nerds.
Of course they were already there, and of course they got kicked out. Nobody likes them. They're the worst. This was just one little episode in the worldwide suppression of the Jesuits that happened at this time. We saw it in Asia. We saw it in Europe. Like, it's everywhere. Basically, European monarchs just got real sick of them. They got sick of their political influence and the influence of Roman Catholicism in, you know, areas that they wanted to be Protestant and all of the above. So all over the world, the Jesuits were getting kicked out of European countries and their colonies. So when they're forced to leave their missions in Baja California, it creates a vacuum that the Franciscans then fill. Serra was appointed president of the newly Franciscan Baja California missions. He would be the head of 15 friars, and his bestie, Francisco Palau, would be his second in command. The Jesuits had established 13 missions in Baja California over the last 70 years. During that time, two of them had been killed by native people. In return, the Jesuits had absolutely fucking decimated the native population with disease. Nice. Like, up to, like, some estimates say 90% of the population. And the Franciscans do not help in this regard. When they arrive, there are probably about 7,000 native people in the area, down from an estimated 60,000 pre-European contact. Again, just an estimate, but still. And by the time the Franciscans leave the missions to the Dominicans and move north in 1772, the native population is down to about 5,000. The Spanish soldiers introduced syphilis into the population wherever they went, and it became endemic in the region, which just caused absolute destruction. So, in 1768, the Inspector General of New Spain decided to send missionaries north along the coast to Alta California. One reason that he may have decided this is because there were increasing reports of Russian expeditions along the coast of California. So it's likely that he was like, well, we better go ahead and like move north and colonize that land before the Russians get to it. Interesting to think that if it like wasn't for Franciscan missions, there is a small chance that we could all be speaking Russian right now. Interesting. Probably not, but maybe. So once again, Serra was chosen to lead the Alta California expedition. He was 55 at this point. This section of Serra's diary is very repetitive. He travels north for a while, his leg hurts, and he wants everybody to know, makes it everybody's problem. He runs into different native peoples. Some of them are nice to him, some are not. Some want to be baptized, some absolutely do not. Some attack their camps and injure or kill other friars. Over and over and over again. He and his companions build little huts that grow into missions, and he stays there for a while and then moves on to start another mission. This seems to be his strong point, is like the initial establishment. And once he sticks around for too long, things start getting really shitty. So like, he's good at the starting point, but when it comes to like actually like working with his fellow friars and the soldiers and the native people, it's like too much for him. He just like pieces out. So Papa was a Rolling Stone. He founded the first mission in San Diego in 1769, and he established 8 more missions in Alta California over the next 13 years. During this time, his headquarters were near Monterey at the Misión San Carlos Borromeo in modern-day Carmel, California. He would often travel up and down the coast between Carmel and San Diego visiting the missions. I'll put a map on Instagram of all of them. Mission life was pretty rough, especially in the beginning. Often food supplies would dry up because the ships from Mexico were late or shipwrecked, and it was difficult to carry supplies overland, like all the way from Mexico City or even just from San Diego to Carmel was difficult. Sarah also got into a conflict with the governor of Alta California, Pedro Fages, in 1772. Basically, what happened was the governor's soldiers were out of control and he wasn't doing anything to reprimand them. On the flip side, the governor thought that Sarah and the Franciscans were too nice to the native people and weren't keeping them in order and protecting his soldiers from them. So they both thought the other one was being shitty and not a good leader. So Sarah actually went to Mexico City to plead his case to the viceroy. The viceroy wanted Sarah to put everything in writing, so he drafted a document called the Representación, which in which he charged Fages with 32 counts of misconduct and also laid out the rights of Native Americans in Spanish California, which placed them under the governance of the missions and protected them from the soldiers. The viceroy ruled in Sarah's favor, and Native Americans living on the missions were guaranteed a few human rights. They were formally recognized as hijos de Dios, or children of God. Again, very paternalistic, very much like, oh, let me just take you poor little children under my wing. Definitely problematic. Could also be seen as more humane than what was going on the East Coast, where Native people were guaranteed no rights at all and could be, you know, like sold or murdered without consequence. So it's complicated. In 1784, Sarah contracted tuberculosis. I'm sure he fucking loved it. Every time he coughed blood into his little handkerchief, I bet he like waved it around and was like, hey. I believe he was sick for about a month. At this point, he was 70 years old, so getting up there. His best friend, Francisco Palau, came from the mission at San Francisco to the Carmel mission to be with him when he learned that he was sick. According to Palau's hagiography, when he came to the mission, Sarah told him, "I thank you for having come to cast a little earth on my grave." Palau was surprised, was like, "What are you talking about? You look so good. You're not sick." Sarah sort of laughed and said, like, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I'm definitely dying soon. Like, I feel it. I'm going to peace out of here like any day now. One day when the two were walking through the mission courtyard together, Sarah asked Palau to bury him in the church. And then he said he needed to rest for a while and went to his room. A few hours later, Palau came to check on him and found him dead. This was August 28th, 1784. Sarah was indeed buried at the mission of San Carlos in Carmel. His body and shrine remain there today. I've seen it, actually. I went to Christmas Mass at the Carmel Mission Church in 2021 on my honeymoon. Normal honeymoon behavior. Go to the shrine of Junipero Serra for Christmas Mass. I didn't know all of this information when I went there. It's a very beautiful place. All the California missions have been restored and are frankly gorgeous. But knowing now all the history and the grossness of it all, it definitely changes the memory of being there. Like, oh shit, like this is the church where, you know, the priests like herded the women, the Native women, into, you know, like for mass. But yeah, anywho. Junipero Serra was beatified in 1988 by Pope John Paul II, and he was canonized in 2015 by Pope Francis. The process of his canonization has been a very controversial one. He is a very controversial figure, so that makes sense. A lot of stuff, like statues and iconography and things having to do with him, like street names in schools, for example, are named after him in California. A lot of that stuff has been vandalized recently. By recently, I mean like 2018 through 2020-ish. The Carmel Mission Church was vandalized in, I believe, 2018. Someone decapitated his statue and painted Saint of Genocide on the church in red paint. Supporters of Serra maintain that he truly cared for the native people on the missions and wanted to save their souls, and that accusing him and the other missionaries of genocide is ascribing modern morality to 18th century actions. There are supporters of him among Native people as well. Obviously, not all of them. It's sort of like he's sort of a less popular Saint Kateri. You know, we have like the Tekakwitha conference named after Kateri, where like, you know, Catholic clergy meet with like Native leaders and it's like a fun time for people. There's nothing like that for him. But he does have some supporters among Native people. I don't think it's my place to say whether he was a good or an evil figure. If I had to say something, give some kind of judgment about it, which I don't know that I do, but if I did, I feel like because he was kind of the face and the founder of these missions, that he has become sort of a catch-all figure for people's anger at, like, righteous and rightful anger at the colonization itself. So, like, whether he should be, like, demonized as a person, I don't know. But I definitely know that he shouldn't be a saint. like, we should probably start there, right? Like, this guy? Really? Okay, interesting. So I think mostly he was kind of just a guy who facilitated some good things and some very awful things. Like, I don't think that should qualify him as a saint. Anyway, I also think that above all, we should listen to Native people on these issues. So I wanted to finish with some quotes from part 5 of the book, The Missions of California. This part is called The Indian Testimony, and it includes over 20 essays by and interviews with Native people on what they think of Serra. A lot of these people, these are oral traditions that have been passed down from their grandparents, their great-grandparents, and so on, who were actually at the missions. And so, like, this is the best we can get of, like, the written record of what Native people thought of him. So I think it's important. So I just have 3 little excerpts. So Max Mazzetti, the tribal chairman of the Rincon Reservation, this is like in the 80s, I think. So, you know, these people could have passed away by now, or at least be holding different offices or whatever. But he writes, quote, "How can they canonize or even respect a man who set up this horrible mission system? I don't know of a single Indian in all the southern counties who hasn't got some kind of horror story or more about the missions and what they did to our people," unquote. Rosalie Robertson, a member of the Kumeyaay tribe, whose great-grandparents died at a mission, writes, quote, "One way they had was to get to the people through the children. They would take the children up on the cliff and drop them down the cliff and kill them. You can get people to show you just where that happened. They call that place the Crying Rock today." And finally, Tony and Pete Savala, who are Chumash, write that, quote, "When the priests came, Maybe they did believe they were bringing God to the people. But we already had our own religion. We knew God. And they had no right to think we were not human and treat us like animals. Indians don't and never did treat animals like they treated us. That is the story of Junipero Serra.
A lot to sit with.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really like him the second that I found out he was so into punishment. Not even necessarily like his own like self-flagellation, but just like, it's great that God punishes us and puts us through all of this pain. If they gave it, he's kind of the one who shot us and then was like, all right, and now I'm gonna heal you.
Mm-hmm. Like,
not fucking shot me.
Right. Yeah, that's valid. Valid critique of Catholic theology as a whole. Yeah.
So, I mean, there are some saints that I have kind of maybe vibed with as people.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely not somebody I would have been able to hold a conversation with.
Definitely not.
We would have had a bunch of ideological differences.
Mm-hmm.
And just, God, I hate missions.
Yeah. I also am not convinced that he literally ever spoke to a woman in his entire life, except like maybe his mom and sister.
Do we have proof?
His sister, he wrote a letter to.
He doesn't mean he spoke to her.
It's true. Also, he was like gone from the family home at the age of like 7. So,
in his letter when he left, it was just like, bye. I hope that you guys find some peace because I'm like super fucking stoked to leave you guys. By the way, make sure everybody in the family is Christian while I'm gone.
By the way, you're all gonna starve to death. Love you, bye. Yeah. What a guy.
He's that family member.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I need to decompress. I need to drink 16 glasses of wine.
I do too. I forget how long Europeans have been in the Americas, and then I'm confronted with that knowledge, and it's never nice. It's never a good time.
It's pretty rough. Yeah. It was wild being in Carmel. And like, now I'm thinking back about like, you know, when I was reading the, like doing all the research this week. And then like thinking back, like every time I saw a name, I'd be like, oh, that's a street name in Carmel. Like that governor, like, oh, Portola Drive is named after Portola, the governor, you know? And I'm like, it's everywhere. That like influence is everywhere.
It sucks so much.
It really does.
Businesses, schools, sometimes hospitals.
Yeah.
And it's so controversial. Because if you propose taking any of that stuff away, people in America will fit.
Right, but it's like, first we have to agree, in order to like make those changes, like first we have to agree that what happened was bad.
And nobody like, to agree.
We're not even there yet. Like there's so far to go. And it seems like really simple from our perspective, I feel like, but like, I don't know. The Catholic Church is the Catholic Church and doesn't like to admit wrongdoing ever, literally ever. And it sucks because Pope Francis is like comparatively kind of a chill dude, but like he really wanted this guy to be canonized. He didn't have to do all that.
No. And he, like, what did this dude even really do? It wasn't anything super miraculous.
No miracles are attributed to him.
No, he just converted a bunch of people against their wishes.
Yeah. Enslaved people.
Good for him.
Gave everybody syphilis. Not personally, but...
Gretchen is mosquito, right?
Scratched the shit out of his disgusting leg and waved it around for all to see. What a fucking freak. What a... I just, like, I'm embarrassed for the other saints that he is on the same level as them, you know? Like, I bet...
He's just up there in heaven showing off his infected leg.
Saint Hildegard is like, what the fuck? What are you doing here?
All of them who've been, like, pressed to death, stoned, and decapitated, shot, and all of this. And he's like, look at my infected leg.
Right.
That I infected.
That I did myself. My greatest work. He sucks. I'm doing someone good next time. I'm doing someone I like.
I look forward to it.
Because I've had this asshole, and then I had Thomas Aquinas. I'm sick of these men.
An existential crisis about your faith.
Well, I mean, that was in the works for several months, if He's not years.
Often.
Truly. He definitely didn't help.
Well, find somebody fun next time. Somebody
I will.
Happy. Somebody you like.
I will. It'll be fun and happy. I mean, I think we need another episode like the Titanic one.
Yes.
So I've been thinking about that, but I can't find anything like similar but different.
It'll hit you.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for listening. And I apologize for trauma dumping Junipero Serra on you. If I had to learn it, so do you. And yeah, we will see you next time. Thanks be to God.
Blessed be.